So, favorite bread? Huh?
What? That's a Bible verse. It's bread?
There's a bread called Ezekiel 4:9. What's it made with? Is it smooth? Is it rough? Is it like eating lumber? Favorite bread? Wait, wait, wait. Let's talk to our Navy boy who is back with us. Chris! Favorite bread? There you go. I thought after eating Navy mess, you would just say anything. Anything. Favorite bread? Someone over here. Favorite bread? Yo. Huh? Bagels. Well, okay, we probably should have not just grain, but actual bread. But bagels works. Challah bread. Doesn't make good French toast, but it's a great bread. Who? Gluten? No. See, here's how I look at gluten-free. And I know there's a lot of people gluten-free, and I pray for you every day because, A, the bread has no taste. B, if you go out to eat and you want gluten-free whatever, they charge you like $5 more. So it's tasteless and costs more. Someone has a racket going. But those of you who are not gluten-free, bread, believe it or not, even when they're putting gluten in it, has played a major role in culture for now 30,000 years. Archaeologists have found that the first Homo sapien type people were making grain into some crude form of bread. And it has moved on to be part of our culture, part of our societies, for all of history, right? Since almost the very beginning of time. And for example, it's been such an important part of our diet. In the Middle Ages, 80% of the average person's calories came from bread or bread products. In the 19th century, it was about 30%. And today, depending on the study, that you anywhere from 10 to 17% of the average American's diet comes from bread or bread products. So it is a really big thing. Not only is it part of our diet of what we eat, bread also has baked itself into our language. Nobody got the pun? Thank you, wife. Man, I've worked hard on these puns. Pretend. For you, Tom. Just for you. My punster. The word companion. You know what it means? Come means with. Panis means bread. And so the best definition of companion is someone who you break bread with. That's a companion. The word Lord comes from the Old English, Halford, which means keeper of the bread. So it's been part of our diet and part of our culture and part of our language. It's who we are. It's how we've been. It's how it's been for a very long time. Bread is a big thing. So it's no wonder that in 1921, a bakery decided they can make a lot of dough by figuring out how to mass. Thank you now. Did you like that one? Did you catch the first one, the wonder? Yeah, wasn't that cute? I am so glad you're married to me because you just make me feel good. Now I've lost my place. Wonder Bread. 1921, a bakery, a baking company decided they needed to cash in on the bread thing, and so they figured out how to mass produce bread without real dough, some other substance, so it wouldn't have the little holes in it, and it was a white bread, which I know isn't good for you, but it still tastes better than any other kind of bread. And they had this wonderful product, but they had no idea what to call it. And so the vice president of the company got assigned the job of naming this bread. And his name was Eric Klein. And Mr. Klein he didn't know what to name the thing. So one day he's at a hot balloon race in Indianapolis Speedway, and he is amazed by all the color of balloons in the sky. In fact, if you read his journal, he said it was a wonder how it was, and that's what he decided to call the bread Wonder Bread, which is why there are balloons of different colors on the bread. Isn't that fascinating? Now, I got to be honest, when I was growing up, I didn't know why they called it Wonder Bread, nor did I care. Because the only thing that mattered to me is that's the bread my mom bought, because that was the best bread available to this day. Wonder Bread is still better than that 9-grain thick there. Anyhow, but all I cared about was if I took this piece of Wonder Bread and slabbed some Peter Pan smooth peanut butter on it, and took this piece of Wonder Bread and put Welch's grape jelly on it, Peter Pan smooth, Welch's grape, stick them together, it was heaven. I believe when I was a kid, this was the manna found in Exodus. This is the food of gods. And to this day, when I'm stressed, I get a piece of bread, not Wonder, because it's not allowed in our house. We're not allowed to have white bread. So I get a piece of cardboard. I still get my Peter Pan smooth and my Welch's grape, and I have a peanut butter jelly sandwich, because to me, there's nothing better than PB&J on Wonder Bread. Nectar and food of gods is what it is. It's in the Bible somewhere. Now, actually, it probably really isn't in the Bible, because Wonder Bread wasn't around the first century. And I don't think anyone had yet invented peanut butter jelly. But even though they could never have a meal with Wonder Bread and peanut butter and jelly, in the first century, in the days that Jesus walked this earth, meals were very important. Because unlike us today, mealtime was not about the food you ate. Mealtime was about the people you shared a table with. Mealtime was not about how fast you can eat, what's on TV. It's about friends and families. First century world would never thought of fast food or eating on the run. For them, meals were an event. And they wouldn't last 15 minutes. They would go into the night, because it was all about making connections and building community around a table breaking bread. That's what was important. That's what mattered. Now, for Jesus, it was important, the connection in the community. But for also Jesus, he used the mealtime to teach valuable lessons. In fact, I once heard it said that when Jesus wanted to teach an important lesson, he didn't offer a theory, he offered people a meal. And if you look in Scripture again and again and again and again, you will find Jesus doing something in context of a meal. Lives were transformed, Zacchaeus, around a meal. When Nicodemus wanted to have Jesus and find out about being born again, it was around at the nighttime, it was around a meal. In fact, meals were so important to Jesus, Luke tells us something that most of us don't remember Luke saying. In the 7th chapter, the 34th verse, Luke says, Jesus came eating and drinking. In fact, according to Luke, he loved to eat and drink so much that he was often called a glutton or a drunkard. Because for Jesus, the meal was just not just a place to just eat, it was a place to celebrate. It was a place of festivity. It was a place of connection, of building relationships. The mealtime was central to the teaching of Jesus. In fact, if you look especially in Luke's gospel, when Jesus talks about heaven, it's often described in terms of a banquet or of a feast. In the prodigal son, when the son comes home, what's the first thing they do? They kill the fatted calf because they didn't have Wonder Bread. So they went with the fatted calf and they had a party. And that's how Jesus describes heaven. Now, I like that because when you hear other descriptions of heaven by people, you get this sense that all you're doing is sitting on a cloud, having wings, and playing a harp of boring music. I like the idea that heaven's going to be a party and a banquet with lots of eating and festivities going on and a lot of noise and no harps. I just think it's going to be fun. And that's what Jesus wanted us to know, because Jesus came eating and drinking. Now, the early church understood that. The early church understood it so much that they formed the church based around covered dish suppers. Seriously, they were Methodists. They didn't know it. They were Methodists in East Texas, and they never knew it. Right? And if you don't believe me, open your Bibles to Acts chapter 2. This is the description Luke gives of the early church. Now listen closely here. The believers devoted. Now I love the word devoted. If you're one of those people underlying your Bible like you should be, underline and circle the word devoted, because that tells us that it wasn't occasionally, it wasn't accidentally. This is something they were fully 100% committed to. And what were they committed to? They were committed to the teaching, to the community, to the shared meals, and to their prayers. You notice that order, right? Teaching, preaching, community, eating, then prayers. Now, in the classic spiritual disciplines, no one ever puts eating as a spiritual discipline. But according to the first church, it was that important. And they did it together. Not on the run, not in a restaurant, but in homes. Keep going. A sense of awe came over everyone, and God performed many wonders and signs to the apostles. Now, I happen to believe the reason why God performed many signs and wonders is because the apostles were always together, and they had this deep connection, which then led to the next thing. All the believers were united and shared everything. They would sell pieces of property and possessions and distribute the proceeds to everyone who needed them. You ever wonder why they did that? They weren't forced to. There wasn't a law. They did it because they spent so much time around the table that they had this deep relationships with one another. And so when they saw someone in need, they didn't even hesitate sharing. Verse 46, every day they met together in the temple and ate in their homes. They shared food with gladness and simplicity. Do you notice? In the early church, when Luke takes the time to describe it, he talks about preaching and he talks about prayer, but what's the main image? That of breaking bread together and sharing a meal, because for the first century church, everything happened around a table. And community together. They were connected. And we've lost that. I mean, our way of life is to be not connected. And I thought about that, and it really has bothered me, because I try to figure out, when did that start? When did all of a sudden we started to disconnect from one another and begin to isolate ourselves? And because I thought back to my own growing up, and we were very connected to our neighbors. And so what I decided, this is my own theory, you can disagree with it if you want. I decided it wasn't a sudden thing, it was this evolution over time that caused us. And I think the beginning, the thing that kicked it off, that started, was the invention of the air conditioner. Now, I love air conditioning. Don't take it away from me. But before every house was air conditioned, in the evening, you'd sit out on your front stoop, or in Texas, your front porch. But where I grew up, your front stoop, and you would talk and know your neighbors. And then air conditioning came around and gave you an excuse to stay inside because it was much cooler. I think that was a start. And then after air conditioning came the garage. When we first moved to Florida, we didn't have a garage. We had a carport, which was basically just four posts and a thing that covered the car, a roof. And when you got out of the car, you may actually see a neighbor and actually say hi. Amazing. Then the carport became a garage. And when the garages were first made, they would detach from the house. Not by a little way, but a big detachment. So you had to get out of your car and walk across this thing to get to your house. And again, you were actually outside where you may run into a person, right? So then the garages became attached. You could drive in your driveway, jump out of your car, open the garage door, pull your car and close the garage door and get in your house, into your air conditioner before anybody even saw you, right? Then became the garage door opener. All of a sudden, you pull in your driveway, you hit a button, the garage door opens, you pull in, the garage door closes, you get out, get in your air conditioner house. And it didn't stop there, because then HOAs came around, right? And they required fences in the yards, and not those cute little white picket fences, not even chain link fences. Most HOAs that require fences, you have to have these 8-foot wood fences that normal people can't see over, right? And if you want to talk to your neighbor, you got to look through the crack. Sometimes if you have a neighbor that's bad, that's good. But if you want to connect to your neighbor, not so much. You can now sit in your backyard on the porch, enjoying your fellowship with your family, and barely see your neighbor's house, less alone your neighbor. And then add to that, gated communities. So now, you can drive through a gate to let you in a community, so you get into your fenced yard, drive into your driveway, push a button, open the garage door, pull your car into the garage, push a button, close the garage door, go into your air-conditioned house and never see a soul. You don't have to go out and go shop anymore. You can call Amazon. All right, Amazon now delivers groceries. They now deliver food from restaurants. And don't even get me started about text messaging, which have replaced phone calls which have replaced face-to-face visits. I used to hack off people in Lake Jackson, bunch of Dow engineers. If you're a Dow engineer, I'm sorry. Right? They would always email, right? Everything was an email. They never called, they just emailed. So one day, my SPR chair emailed me. I picked up the phone and called her. What do you need, Bonnie? Well, I emailed you. I know. Well, you're supposed to email me back. Now I decided to break the rule. I want to call you. Imagine that, a conversation. And let's not talk about Facebook, right? Right? We don't even say happy birthday to people anymore, right? We just go on Facebook, make some insincere happy birthday, and you don't know 3/4 of the people that wish you happy birthday. And they don't know you, but it comes up on the little feed. Oh, it's Marty's birthday. Let's go wish him happy birthday. Right? Every once in a while, you hit like so that your friend that you don't really know thinks you know them and thinks you care about what they ate for breakfast and how they exercise. We don't care. Rather than that, just call me and tell me what you did. It's a lot more fun, and actually build connection. We are the most disconnected, connected people in the world. We can wake up and never see another person if we wanted to. Never interact with another soul if that was our desire. And the problem is, what bothers me, it's not just happens out in the world, it happens here. I read a survey that said that one out of the average American comes to church one time a month. And the average churchgoer gets this. The average churchgoer comes in right before the service starts, sneaks somewhere in, not just the back pews. We got people in the middle pews do the same thing, right? Barely talk to anybody. Cringe when it's time for the greeting because you can't think what kind of bread you like, right? Sing a few hymns, do a prayer, throw a couple bucks in the plate, fall asleep during the sermon, wake up for the benediction, and go home. Without talking to a soul. And I know some of you folks don't like when we hold hands for the benediction, but we hold hands for the benediction for that person. Because for just a moment, they have to be connected to somebody. And they have to have a point of contact with somebody. And my hope is when you're holding hands, I make all those announcements, you think I'm doing it just to bug the guys? I fear if you hold hands long enough, you happen not to know the person that you're holding hands with, you may actually say, hey, and develop a connection. See, because you can't do this alone. If you think you can be an independent follower of Jesus, you are wrong. We need one another. Whether you want to admit it or not, we need one another. And we need to be present with one another. That's why we're here. I've been here however long. December 1st, 2013. I don't know how long that's been. I bet you 33% of my sermons have been about community, about being connected. You know why? Because that's what church is for. Worship is about coming together, worshiping together, praying together, serving together, loving together, being together. And if we miss that, just go home. Because I can watch it on TV or listen to a podcast. But I can't get community anywhere but here. And the best place to find community is at a table. People wonder where my whole theology came from. Central to my theology is this idea of being connected in community. It begins and it ends with that. And if you want to read my credo, I'll be happy to send you 28 pages of theological understanding. But the bottom line, it's about community. It's about connection. People want to know where I get that. One of the most vivid memories I have growing up takes place around a table. And not just any table. It was the table. It was a table. Those of you who know me know my mom raised three of us by herself. You know, we were poor, didn't know we were poor, but we were poor. Found out when I was 18, 19 how poor we were. I asked mom one day, you know, mom, we never eat eggplant anymore. She said, well, no, we don't have to. What do you mean you don't have to? I always thought we ate eggplant because it was good for you. No, we couldn't afford meat. That's why we ate eggplant. To this day, much to Jill's chagrin, I won't eat eggplant. You know why? I can afford meat. You know, it's just one of those things. But my mom had this little tradition, you know. Every year when it was your birthday, you could do whatever you want for dinner. She'd make anything you want or take you out to eat as a family together. Only thing she asked for is about a month notice, right? And so November came and mom said, Marty, what do you want to do for your birthday? I had just seen this commercial on TV for a restaurant called Monty's. I knew nothing about Monty's, but it looked pretty cool on TV. So I thought, hey, let's go Monty's, Mom. Okay, we'll go. So yeah, my birthday came, you know, we got dressed up because that's what Mom did. You never went out unless you were dressed up, you know, put Brill cream or whatever in your hair, clip-on tie, white shirt. You know, we went to dinner at Monty's. It was such a cool place. because someone met us at the door, right, and took us to our seat. And we didn't go out to eat. I didn't know that happened. So we get to the table, and this table is covered with a linen tablecloth, white. My mom, in all her days, would never put down a white tablecloth with two boys, right? But we were eating on a white tablecloth, and there were two forks, not one, two. Imagine that. You know, that was high town for us. And I didn't know which fork to use, and we had a knife and a spoon and another spoon here, and in the glass was this linen napkin nicely folded. And it was like the coolest thing. And the menu came, and don't ask me why I ordered this. To this day, I couldn't tell you. And don't ask me why I remember it. I ordered off the menu Hawaiian ham. I had no clue. It sounded good, right? And what it was a slab of ham, right, with a pineapple on it, a cherry in the middle of the pineapple, and one of those plastic swords that held the whole thing together, right? The best part was, by the way, the plastic sword. I was a boy. It was a weapon. Ask my brother. Anyhow, and it came with green beans and scalloped potatoes. We ate. People waited on us. The cake came. Happy birthday. It was a great night. And I was 11 years old. I'm on top of the world. And then the bill came. And I didn't understand a thing that happened at 11. Years later, I got it. Because my mom reached into her purse, pulled out a baggie with some crumpled bills and some quarters and dimes and change, and she carefully counted out whatever she needed to do to pay the bill. And she never said a word. Years later, I would ask her, but when I finally realized what had happened, I asked her about it. She just never said a word, didn't even talk about it. But what I realized around that table, well, my mom had saved for a month, probably doing without, so that her boy could have a Hawaiian ham, pineapple, cherry, and a sword. And I learned about what it means to be connected, what it means to be community, what it means to be together. And I learned about grace and about love and about sacrifice around a table. And that formed my theology and my understanding of this table. Because we're invited this morning to this table. Not a table at Monty's, but a table here. We're invited by the Lord, the keeper of the bread. And he invites us to be his companion, to break bread with him. And when we break bread at this table with the keeper of the bread, it's not just regular bread, it's really wonder bread. Because this is what builds strong bodies. This is what builds strong connection. This is what builds community. So we gather at a table and we hear words we have heard again and again and again, to where we don't even pay attention anymore, but these are words that are life changing. Because we hear words when Jesus took some bread and he gave thanks, but then he broke it. And when he broke it, he offered it. And he said, "This is my body broken for you, and I give it to you because you are my companion. You're my friend. You're the one that I love." And we forget. Then we hear words when he takes a cup and he's again gives thanks and he offers it, and he says, "If you drink this, your sins are forgiven because this is my blood." you are my friends, and I lay down my life for you. And what I've learned, if you want to love like Jesus, you need to forgive, and you need to serve, but most of all, you need to come to a table and be connected and find community. And it happens here, and it can happen now. That's the gospel. That's the heartbeat of what I believe.